Welcome to lecture three. Congratulations on finding it. So this one is the point of view evolved.
Thanks very much, Angela. Thanks very much, everyone, for coming along. So the last couple of weeks I've been sketching a sort of view of epistemology in which we represent the people we're interested in, our kind of epistemic agents, epistemic individuals, as having credences rather than having full beliefs, though they may also have full beliefs and may be interesting questions about how they relate to one another. But I've been largely focusing on the part of their kind of doxastic point of view that is represented by credences, so degrees of belief, as people might say, or strengths of confidence or something like that. And then I've been presenting a range of kind of norms that govern us when we're represented in that way. Some synchronic norms govern us at any particular time, and then some diachronic norms that tell us how our credences should evolve over time, perhaps when we acquire evidence, but perhaps when our conceptual scheme grows and we're better able to represent other possibilities in the world. And then in some ways, a lot of the things I've been saying on that normative side have been reasonably standard, but perhaps slightly less standard has been the kind of mode of justification for those norms, which is this sort of teleological approach that I've been sketching out, where there's the idea is that credences play a number of roles in our lives. One of them is to represent the world correctly, another one is to guide our action, and you can kind of judge credences by how well they perform in each of those roles. And when you judge them in that way and you provide precise measures for how well they do that, you can justify some of those norms, like norm of probabilism or conditionalization or these other ones I've been talking about. But for all I've said so far, I've been sort of guilty of something, a sort of accusation that is levelled at epistemology generally by the sort of literature on inquiry, which has sort of exploded in the last 15 or so years. And that is that I've sort of been presenting these epistemic agents as if they're entirely passive creatures. They kind of go through the world, evidence hits them in the face, and they have to do something about that. They have to do something in response to that evidence, and you have some norm that tells you how you should do that. But as people in this literature have pointed out, that is, of course, how we gain some of our evidence. You know, as I was walking up here today, and I saw my blue tit just sort of flew straight across my point of view. I didn't try to gather that evidence or anything like that. It happened to me. I had to update my credences in some way. But there's another thing I could do. I could go out bird watching. I could kind of go to a particular spot and I could try to kind of see what's there. And that's a sort of reasonably kind of large-scale thing that I could do to try to gather evidence. But just about everything that we do has some component of making it possible that we can gather evidence. So I hear my name called and I turn my head to the side to see who it might be. I'm kind of performing an action that allows me to kind of gather some evidence in some way or get some information about the world. So one question is, can this approach that I've been sketching out, this kind of teleological approach with both its pragmatic and its epistemic components, can that tell us something about how we should guide our inquiry? And the claim of this lecture is, yes, indeed it can. And in some ways, that's not going to be terribly surprising, because one of the things that I said about this sort of creedal approach to epistemology is that it comes with a pretty standard account of how you should act rationally on the basis of your credences, at least once you specify your utilities or something that measures your value to some extent. Once you've sort of specified that, then you should essentially act so as to maximize your expected utility. That's just a very standard thing that people kind of learn in microeconomics 101. That's the kind of rational gold standard for action. And of course, these acts of gathering evidence are simply a particular species of act. They're just a thing that we do. And so the natural thing to say from the point of view that I'm sketching out is to say, well, when should you gather evidence and how should you gather evidence and what sort of evidence should you gather? Well, just at any particular point, you should do any particular evidence gathering action that maximizes expected utility. What's the utility in this sense? Well, it's going to be these either the pragmatic utility or the epistemic utility or the all things considered utility that credences have that I've been defining over the last couple of lectures, and I'll go into again in a little bit more detail. Now, in some ways, then, I could just kind of stop the lecture there and we could go and enjoy the sun, but I'm going to say some more than that. And partly because I want to sort of sketch out the details of the approach, and partly because I think it solves a couple of questions that have come up in this kind of literature on inquiry. And I also, in some ways, this is a sort of proselytizing exercise in trying to persuade you that this kind of approach can solve sort of a whole range of issues. I'll come back to this a little bit later on, but Eric Schlieser has this nice term, totalizing, which he uses for particular approaches that are used across various different disciplines, maybe economics, psychology, sociology, statistics, philosophy. Certain sorts of frameworks or approaches that we can use to sort of communicate with one another and that are supposed to be able to solve a kind of whole range of questions. And in some ways, what I'm kind of pitching here is that this creedal approach that I'm sketching out is one of these. It's kind of got totalizing ambitions. You might call them imperialist ambitions, but I'm hoping the totalizing term has a kind of more appealing ring to it. Okay. So that's the kind of plan of this lecture. So one question that comes up immediately, if we're going to use this framework to understand when we should gather evidence in a particular way, or inquire in a particular way, we're going to have to represent these episodes of what you might call evidence acquisition. I'm kind of calling sort of reasonably neutrally just evidence acquisition. So how are we going to represent these? Because once we get into the business of kind of using this mathematical toolkit to understand these things, we're going to have to understand how we're representing episodes of evidence acquisition. Now, I'm going to sketch out one, because in some ways it's the one that's most often used, but there's no claim here that this is somehow uniquely correct. I'll allude to a slightly more sophisticated version in the next couple of minutes, but there may well be many other ones, but this is supposed to be a sort of proof of concept that you can kind of, however you would like to model evidence acquisition, then you could use this framework perhaps to help understand what the norms are that govern it. And the model I'm going to use is in some ways the kind of straightforward, in some ways intuitive one that we probably think of in most kind of classical cases in epistemology. So what happens? It's an episode of evidence acquisition. Well, something happens to me, that's the first thing. So perhaps light impinges on my retina, or perhaps something kind of pushes against my my touch receptors, or perhaps I hear something, sounds kind of enter. Some way something happens to me, something. And one result of that is that something changes about my cognitive state. Now again, this is a part of the model that you could kind of go in different ways with, but I'm just going to go with the way that what happens is that you form either some sort of belief, or you gain some sort of knowledge, or you become certain of something. So I look over there, and again a blue tick kind of flies past the window, then what happens is something happens to me, and one result of that is that perhaps I form a belief that's going in that direction. And then after that, my cognitive processes kind of get to work on that in order to perhaps kind of change other aspects of my cognitive state to sort of fall into line with that, or to kind of update on the basis of that. So I then maybe conditionalize my credences on the basis of that proposition that I've come to believe or become certain of or know, whatever your kind of favorite account of what the change is in your cognitive state. It's not going to matter for us what that change is. So that's the kind of model. Something happens to you, one aspect of your cognitive state changes, and then on the basis of that, some cognitive process gets to work to change the rest. Now, there's a couple of versions of this model. So the one I'm going to focus on is this one that's sort of due originally to Janine Hossiasson, who we met at the first lecture. And it's in some ways the most common one, but I'll mention in a second also the alternative, slightly more sophisticated one due to David Blackwell. So the Hossiasson one represents a particular episode like this by your evidence function. This is actually Nalanjan Das's terminology, not Hossiasson's. But what happens, what an evidence function does is it takes each of the possibilities that you entertain, remember these personal possibilities that takes each one of those, and it tells you, at that possibility, what the proposition is that you will learn. I'm just using learn here in a neutral way to mean come to know, come to believe, become certain of, whatever. that kind of categorical status that is the change that your cognitive state then gets to work on. So let's imagine that I'm kind of deciding whether or not to go climbing on a particular mountain in Scotland next weekend. And I'm learning that the cloud cover is going to be kind of around 900 meters. So it's going to really matter to me whether this is a good idea or not to know what height the mountain is. But I don't know what height the mountain is. I know the name of it, but I don't know its height. But fortunately, I've got two pamphlets available to me. One of them is called Scotland's High Point. And what it does is it just lists off every mountain above 900 meters. So I know this mountain is either 600 meters, 800 meters, 1,000 meters, or 1,200 meters. Okay, those are the three. I know those are the four possibilities. And if I consult Scotland's High Point, then I'm going to learn, if it's 600 or 800, I'll learn that it's 600 or 800, but nothing more than that. If it's 1,000 or 1,200, I'll learn it's either 1,000 or 1,200, but nothing more than that. Okay. So it won't tell me what the height is, because it just lists the names, it doesn't give the actual height. It doesn't tell me exactly what it is, but it'll give me some information about it. Then there's an alternative pamphlet that I could consult instead called Challenging but Manageable. That lists all the mountains between 800 meters, sorry, that are greater than 700 meters and less than 1,100 meters. So if it's either 600 meters or 1,200 meters, then it's going to tell me it's one of those two, but nothing more than that. If it's 800 or 1,000, then it's going to tell me it's one of those two, it's not going to tell me anything more than that. So the evidence function in this situation just takes each possibility and tells me that that I'll learn in that situation. Now, as I say, there's kind of a lot of subtleties that are out in this area, but there's another way of representing that is you might think of Hoseyasins as a kind of deterministic approach. So what happens is, you know, I'm asked a particular world, it's certain, you know, at that world, it's determined that this is the proposition that I'll learn. And that's in the very clean cases, that's kind of what you would kind of expect to happen. You know, a scientist doing an experiment or someone consulting a compendium or asking a yes-no question to someone, those are cases where it's pretty much determinate. You know that given that the world's this way, this is the thing that I'll learn. Blackwell considers a possibility where, in fact, it's non-deterministic. If the world's this way, you have some probability of getting some signal from it. If the world's this way, you get some other probability of getting some alternative signal. I'm not going to talk about that, but just to highlight, there are these kind of alternative ways of modelling these episodes out. Okay, so now we've got this kind of model for any particular episode of evidence acquisition. And we're wanting to use our framework to decide between them. So either to decide between two different ways of acquiring evidence, you know, reading Challenging but Manageable or reading Scotland's High Point. So trying to decide between two different ways of acquiring evidence, but also trying to decide between acquiring evidence or just not acquiring evidence at all. And indeed, we'd ideally like a framework in which we can choose between acquiring evidence in this way or in that way or not at all or doing something completely separate, like making a sandwich or kind of going and playing tennis or something like that. Because in the situation we're in, often what happens is that we've got to make, you know, our choices are not simply to acquire evidence in this way or to acquire evidence in that way. They're also to do something really completely different that's not an evidence-gathering action at all. And it'd be nice to be able to compare these because that's, in fact, the things that you're faced with in your life. You're rarely faced with situations where you must acquire evidence, but you have to choose which way it is. You're often situations where you can acquire some evidence, or you can go off and do something completely different that doesn't involve acquiring evidence. Okay, so now we want a way of kind of judging the utility or the value of acquiring evidence in this way. And I'll just quickly run through Hoseyasins' account of this because I sort of went through some of, it is a version of the account that I gave in the first lecture of the kind of pragmatic utility of having credence. So if you remember, if you were present, and if in the first lecture I was building on Hoseyasin to suggest that the pragmatic utility of having particular credences, when you know you're going to face a particular decision, it's just a kind of choice between various options, the utility of it, the particular way the world might be, is this just the utility of whatever those credences would lead you to choose from that decision problem. OK, Okay, so you face a decision problem, a range of options, maybe five different options. You've got some credences. You're going to look at each of the options, figure out their expected utility, pick one of the ones that has the greatest. You're going to take the utility, pragmatic utility of your credences to just be the utility of whatever option they lead you to choose. This is the kind of classic pragmatist account. In some ways, this is spelling out precisely what you find in Person and James and in other sorts of places. So this is the pragmatic utility of acquiring, of having certain credences when you know you're going to face a particular decision problem. And Hosseinson essentially just says, what's the pragmatic utility of a particular evidence gathering episode for someone with certain kind of prior credences? Well, when they know they're going to face a particular decision problem later on, it's just going to be the utility of whatever they would be led to choose from that decision problem. Were they to acquire the evidence, update their credences on them, and then use those updated credences to make the decision. So in some ways, it's kind of just what you would expect. How good is it to get some new evidence before making a decision? Well, it's just however good your option would be that you'd be led to choose if you acquire the evidence, updated on it, and use those updated beliefs to make your decision. So I've kind of spelled out on this in a little bit of detail on the handout. So I suppose I'm making this decision whether or not to climb this mountain, climb or don't climb. Don't climb, let's just say it gets zero utilities each possibility, and climb, that really depends on what height the mountain is, because I don't want to go get to the top and it be in the middle of the clouds. If I come and it's below the clouds, then great, I'll get a nice view. If it's above the clouds, I'll get one of those amazing views across the clouds. But if I'm right in the middle of them, it's going to be hopeless. So utilities depend on where the clouds are lying. Where the clouds are lying and also the height of the mountain. I don't know the height of the mountain. So I could inquire and I could kind of figure out, use my credences after inquiry to make my decision. And it's going to turn out that for the way that I've spelt it out, then you consult Scotland's highest points, then it turns out that doesn't actually change whether you'll climb or not. And so that's basically got exactly the same utility at every possibility as just sticking with your original credence. Okay, but there's a way I've spelt out the details of it, given the kind of prior probabilities and so on. If I read challenging but manageable, then that will indeed change my decision, at least in some worlds, and it will change them in those worlds in a way that's kind of beneficial. I'll avoid the kind of particularly bad situation. Okay, so that's kind of spelled that out a little bit more detail in the handout. But essentially what happens there is that you get a way of comparing, given a particular decision problem that you're going to face, a way of comparing different ways of acquiring evidence. Are they going to serve me better or worse when I then come to face that particular decision problem? But of course, as I said in the first lecture, we're not always sure what decision problem we'll face. We're not always sure what we'll use these credences after acquiring some evidence, we're not sure what decisions we'll use them to face. And indeed, part of the point of credences is to be sort of all-purpose kind of tools that we can use to make any decision that comes our way. And so what we do to kind of specify the pragmatic utility of credences is to put some uncertainty about what decision we'll face. And then represented perhaps by a probability function, and then take the pragmatic utility of a particular set of credences to just be the kind of expected utility of using those to face whatever decision problem we in fact face, given that we're currently a bit uncertain about which one we'll face. And then I kind of spelled out earlier what that kind of measure of this epistemic utility is going to look like. It's going to have certain properties, like, for instance, being what people call strictly proper, as long as your uncertainty is a particular way. So, of course, you can then build on that to give the pragmatic utility of a particular way of gathering evidence or kind of episode of gathering evidence. How do you do that? Well, you just once again take the pragmatic utility of gathering evidence to be the pragmatic utility of whatever credences you would end up with as a result of getting that evidence and then update. So that's the kind of Hosseinson's way of understanding it, kind of absolutely core pragmatist intuition that the kind of good of a particular evidence gathering episode or experiment that you might do or inquiry that you might undertake is the pragmatic utility of the credences that will give rise to, and those are just the utilities of the things they will be led to choose. And then the kind of central, the thing that Hoseyasin's actually making this definition in order to give us is this kind of result that she proves in this paper, which gets known later on as something like the value of information theorem, but she's actually proving a slightly more general version of it, which tells you in certain circumstances, when two evidence-gathering episodes are related in a particular way, you can be absolutely guaranteed whatever priors you have and whatever decision problem you're going to face or whatever your uncertainty over those decision problems, you can be sure that gathering the evidence in this way is going to be better than gathering the evidence in that way. I won't go into that in too much detail. But there's a kind of general result here, and it kind of goes that essentially kind of builds on Hoseyasin's original theorem, but you can kind of is a little bit more general than that, that I think Graham Oddie is the first person to have stated. And that says, look, if you're measuring the kind of utility, the value of your credences in a particular way, either for how well they represent the world, that's their epistemic value, or for how well they guide your action, that's their pragmatic value. And if those measures have the properties that I was talking about in the first lecture, namely that term that they're strictly proper, that is, that any particular probabilistic credences expect themselves to be doing better than anyone else, then you're going to get this kind of general theorem which tells you certain circumstances in which you can be sure that this kind of evidence gathering is going to be better than that kind of evidence. And that's a really, you know, it's kind of remarkable theorem. Well, in some ways, it's one of those funny theorems, I think, that is to some extent straightforward once you see all the definitions. One of those theorems where the key is in giving the definition. Once you give the definitions, it's actually a reasonably kind of three or four line proof. But giving the definitions is the kind of crucial fact. And I think that they're kind of interesting results, but really the value of that contribution is to understand this way of comparing different evidence gathering episodes. So we've got a particular result that tells us when evidence-gathering episodes are related in this way, then the first one's guaranteed to be better than the second one. And that's very interesting, but we don't always come across, you know, our evidence-gathering episodes that we're comparing aren't always related in that way. And so we want some way of... So the value of the framework is to give you this way of comparing them all the same. So you can just calculate expected... the pragmatic or epistemic utility of gathering evidence in a particular way. What is it in the pragmatic case? Well, it's just the expected value of whatever option it is that you're going to end up choosing, having started with your prior, gathered the evidence, updated from the evidence, chosen using that updated credences. What's the value that you get out of that? Do an expectation over that, and that's your kind of judgment about how good it would be for you to engage in this kind of way of gathering. Yeah. And you can see there's a kind of nice example here which is riffing on Nalanjan Das's treatment of Tim's case of the unmarked clock. But you can see a kind of case where, in fact, it's not going to be a good idea to gather evidence. So suppose one other thing, I could take out the kind of, you know, Scotland's high points, or I could take out the challenging but manageable pamphlet. And it turns out in those cases, I'm guaranteed whatever my priors are, whatever decision problem I face, or whatever uncertainty I have about them, or however I'm measuring epistemic utility, for those ones, it's guaranteed that I'll be better off gathering that evidence than not gathering it. But in this, there's another kind of evidence that you could get where that's not going to be the case, and in fact, you should try to avoid that evidence. So suppose, and so this is the case that I've got on page 4, this kind of other sorts of evidence. So suppose instead of pulling the pamphlets out and reading them, maybe they've kind of been far away, or I've left them back in my hotel or something like that, I think, oh, I can kind of eyeball the mountain. Maybe that's the right thing to do. I just kind of look at it and kind of make a judgment about how high it is. And suppose in that case, you know, my judgment's a little bit kind of dicey. If it's either 600 or 800 metres, I'll learn it's 600, 800, or 1,000. Either 800, or if it's either 1,000 or 1,200, I'll learn it's 800, 1,000, or 1,200. The crucial feature there is that those two things that I might possibly learn overlap. They don't form a partition. And then you can, turns out, you can specify certain priors that you might have such that you will in fact actively not want to gather that evidence. You'll think it's, you'll make yourself worse off. Now you might think that's an incredibly puzzling thing to happen, because surely one thing that we can kind of agree on is that when I acquire true evidence, and in that case the propositions I'm learning there is true, when I'm acquiring true evidence, surely my kind of creedal state, my epistemic state, my doxastic component of my point of view improves. So that's why we gather evidence. We want to get evidence so that our creedal state improves. And so if that's the case, then in some ways Hosiasen's theorem surely is just completely unmysterious. Of course it's always going to be good to gather evidence. Why? Well, because whatever the evidence tells me, as long as it's true, I'm going to improve my epistemic state by learning it and updating. But of course that's not true. And that's exactly what misleading evidence is. Okay, you can get evidence such that is true. You learn it, but you become worse off epistemically as a result of it. So what Hosiasen's theorem essentially tells us is that there are certain ways that evidence can be, such that it's still possible that the evidence that I acquire is misleading, but whatever detriment I get by acquiring that misleading evidence, it will be outweighed by the benefits that I'll get in other situations. So Hosiasen's conditions don't assure you that your evidence is not misleading. Evidence can still be misleading in her kind of cases. And it can still be possible that when you get the evidence, you'll end up being worse off in certain situations. But in other situations, you will have improved sufficiently that as long as these conditions hold, you'll be guaranteed that that improvement outweighs the loss. Okay, and that's exactly what doesn't happen in the case I've just talked about with eyeballing the mountain. I learn these things and they're misleading in particular ways, and they're misleading in ways that they don't end up counterbalancing one. Okay. But the important thing that we have now is an account of the utility, the kind of value, whether it's epistemic or pragmatic or some sort of combination, all things considered, of acquiring different bits of evidence from the point of view of your current creed. I update them. I look at the different possible ways the world might be. I look at what I'll learn at them. I look at what would happen if I update them and what I learn in those situations. And then I look at what the kind of utility is of the inferences that I get as a result of them. Okay, so having specified all of that, and kind of coming back to the thing that I said right at the beginning of the lecture, I could have kind of finished this lecture in a sort of five-word motto, which is, well, when the question is how should you inquire, the answer is you should just maximize your expected utility. So you should gather evidence in a particular way when, out of the options that are available to you at the time, which will include other ways of gathering evidence perhaps, or not gathering evidence at all, or doing something completely different, like going off and playing tennis, in that situation, you should inquire or gather evidence exactly when doing so maximizes expected utility, or at least it becomes permissible when it maximizes and when it uniquely maximizes its requirement. So now we seem to have a kind of norm of inquiry that comes out of this approach. And again, could kind of wrap things up there. But there's some more to say. One thing that you might think sort of puzzling is that I've been sort of sliding a little bit between episodes of evidence acquisition, which are kind of just very local, one-off cases where, you know, the choice is turn my head in this direction when I hear my voice call, or my name called, perhaps, or, look up this particular pamphlet. But actually what people in the inquiry literature are interested in are not these just one-off instances, but whole sequences of evidence, and indeed plans for how you are going to inquire into something. So a series of evidence-gathering episodes. You know, if I want to discover something like, kind of how many blue tits there are in the country, then I'm going to have to do a lot more than just look out the window and see one flying past. I'm going to have to set up some sort of survey, and I'm going to have to plan all these things. I'm going to have to do lots and lots of things, many observations over many. So you might think, okay, maybe you've given some account of the norms that govern these kind of one-off episodes, but what about these kind of, what's happened to these kind of larger scale plans that we make? How do they figure at all into our theorizing? Because it looks like you just don't need to talk about inquiries any longer. You just say, I've told you exactly what you've got to do at exactly every moment of your life. You've just got to always maximize expected utility at every single moment. There's no kind of role for these longer inquiries to play. I think the thing to say about this, and I'm kind of grateful to Michaela Kelly who suggested this, is that you want to look at these a little bit like Michael Bratman looks at intentions. So can imagine what your life would be like if in fact you had to kind of assess at every point throughout it what maximizes expected utility at that point from the options that are available to you. An enormously costly activity to undertake. And of course, it would be really nice if somehow you had some automatic process in your brain that didn't require you to do this consciously, but rather just kind of did it right every time. But again, that seems kind of computationally incredibly demanding. And so what we might think you do instead of kind of making these reevaluations at every single point in your life, you make some sort of plan, long-term kind of plan, Bratman-style kind of intention. And then you kind of just instead of reevaluating at every point, you just continue to follow through that plan. Even if it turns out that might not be, following through on that plan might not be, by the time you get to a particular point, the thing that maximizes expected utility, you're just not reevaluating things. You're kind of just following through on the plan because you're a bounded agent and you don't have the resources. So you might think of inquiry as a little bit like that. It's kind of it's like an Bratman-style intention, sort of like a plan that you make so that you don't have to reevaluate at every single point what's going on. So when I decide I'm going to discover how many blue tits there are in the country, I make a sort of plan that it has a series of steps that I commit to. And I don't make the decision at every single point in that just to decide whether that still maximizes my expected. I just follow through on the plan. And maybe I assess at the beginning whether that plan in some sense has high or maximizes expected utility at the plans that I might make. Okay, so I think that's one thing that you can say about this. Okay, so now I want to move on to a couple of sort of issues that have been raised in the inquiry literature. Indeed, I'm going to start off with the case that I think is what launches the recent literature inquiry, which is Jane Friedman's case of the glazier. So here's the example. I'm actually paraphrasing. This isn't exactly the central points are the same, but I give a slightly different version because it's better for illustration for my purposes. So Jane is someone who, not Jane Friedman, not Jane, is someone who is a glazier, and they have learned that the tender for the contract to reglaze the Chrysler Building is about to be put out, and she wants to put in a bid for that contract, an incredibly lucrative contract. So she hotfoots it down to Grand Central Station, which I'm reliably told has a good view of the Chrysler Building, and she kind of looks up and she starts counting. She wants to know exactly how many windows there are in the Chrysler Building so she knows what kind of bid to put in for her, how much she expects this to cost. So she's engaged in a kind of classic inquiry. This is like one of these plans that I was saying, rather than kind of reevaluating at every point as she counts the windows, she's just kind of got this plan to do it, and so she starts kind of counting windows in the Chrysler Building. But of course, this takes a long time, and if anyone's stood outside Grand Central Station, it's a reasonably busy place, and so she gains other evidence as she stands there counting windows. For instance, she might overhear a terribly interesting conversation where someone points out that Madison Avenue runs northeast to southwest. Okay, so she gains that evidence in some ways. So if we look back at the model that I had in the first page, something happens to her like that. Those sounds perhaps kind of come into her ear, and something changes. Perhaps she kind of comes to form the belief, you know, Madison Avenue runs northeast, southwest. But she's concentrating hard. She's concentrating on counting the windows. So she doesn't kind of draw out all the consequences of that new evidence that she's acquired. And there are consequences that she could draw out, because it turns out a couple of weeks ago, in an idle moment, she noticed that Madison Avenue and Park Avenue are parallel to one another. And so she now has evidence that, if she were to put it together, would teach her that Park Avenue also runs northeast. But she can't do both of these things. She can't both draw out the consequences of the evidence that she's just acquired in her ear and also continue to count. You know, we're all limited agents. There's only a certain amount of stuff that we can do at any particular time. So it's not possible for her to do both of those things. She can carry on counting, and then she won't draw out the consequences of the evidence she's acquired, or she can stop counting, think about what she'd learned before about the parallel of Madison and Park, and then figure out this fact about Park. And Friedman thinks that this kind of highlights a clash between what she thinks of as epistemic norms, standard classic epistemic norms from epistemology, and what she calls zetetic norms, which are norms that that govern our inquiry. So what's the epistemic norm? Well, if you have excellent evidence for a particular proposition at a time, then you're permitted to judge it at that point. Okay. Like a classic kind of thing. You might want a stronger one that you ought to judge it, but all sorts of reasons like Gil Harman's stuff about kind of cluttering up the mind that means that you probably don't want to say you ought to do it. But nonetheless, you're permitted to do it. But there's also a zetetic norm, a kind of norm of inquiry, which says if you want to figure out the answer to a question, then you ought to take the necessary steps to figuring that out. But that second one clashes with the first one, because if she ought to continue, you know, carry on with the inquiry that she's interested in, the answer to the question, how many windows there are on the Chrysler Building, that means, in fact, that she cannot also draw out the consequences for evidence. So she has evidence that strongly supports that Park Avenue runs from northeast to southwest. But she can't draw it out without kind of failing to focus on the inquiry, but she's got this norm that tells her she must focus on the inquiry, so she can't in fact do this thing. And so there's this kind of clash between these two norms. I want to sort of suggest that you can answer something like, you can find a solution to this kind of clash between them, resolution of this conflict between epistemic norms and zetetic norms in this framework that I've been kind of spelling out. But to do that, we've got to say a little bit more, or do say something a little bit more controversial about the framework than what I've been sort of relying on so far. Okay, so this is halfway down, page 5. So Jane's got this choice to make. She either carries on counting the windows, or she's got a reason for her evidence. And what I want to say is that in those two cases, we can represent her as choosing between two different ways of gathering evidence or having a kind of evidence acquisition episode. Now, you might think, no, that's clearly not what's going on there, because one of them is gathering evidence, the one where you carry on counting the windows. The other one is not gathering evidence, it's drawing facts out from your evidence, drawing consequences out from your evidence. But we can understand these as essentially the same thing if we understand our agents or epistemic agents as being uncertain about a priori facts, like facts such as line A goes this direction and line A is parallel to line B, then line B goes the same direction. So if he's uncertain about that fact, if he's certain about that fact, but he, So what I want to do in this case is represent Jane as having personal possibilities that include things that are not logically possible or not conceptually possible or not metaphysically possible. Okay. So in the first lecture, when I introduced these personal probabilities, I said that there are really ways the world could be but described at the finest level of grain that's possible using her representational apparatus. Okay. That was the idea, that they're kind of possible worlds but not quite as you might think of them from metaphysics. They're kind of ways the world could be, but only grained to the level that that your particular agent could actually understand them, that their representational apparatus allows that. But I didn't say at any point what modality I was using there, and I'd sort of been assuming throughout that we're really just kind of talking about logically and metaphysically possible worlds throughout. But at this point, I want to say, actually, no, you can also allow in logical impossibilities and conceptual impossibilities and metaphysical impossibilities. Because, of course, those are things that, of which people can be uncertain. There's many, many very complex logical facts of which I'm not certain. And in some sense, then, I have some personal possibility at which those facts are false, and some at which they're true. Okay. And what happens is I kind of learn logical facts, perhaps by doing truth tables or doing mathematical reasoning or something like that, is I come to rule out those logically impossible worlds. But they've kind of got to be there in the first place to really represent the sort of uncertainty that I have. And that's sort of how I'm going to suggest that we should understand Jane in this situation. So just after she learns that Madison Avenue runs from northeast to southwest, she's going to have some positive credence in each of the following sentences. So remember, she already knew that Madison Avenue and Park Avenue were parallel to one another. She'd ruled out all the possibilities where that wasn't true. And now she's also been able to rule out all the possibilities where Madison Avenue runs anything other than northeast, southwest. But what she hasn't done yet, the piece of reasoning that she hasn't performed yet, is the thing that would allow her to infer from those two pieces of information to the direction of Park Avenue. And so she still has positive credences, perhaps, in these four possibilities that I put out the handout, that Madison Avenue runs northeast, southwest, and Madison is parallel to Park, but that perhaps Park runs north-south, or northwest-southeast, or east-west. Of course, we know, and when we look at them, and if she were to attend to them, she would pretty quickly know that those aren't really possibilities, because she knows what it means for two things to be parallel. She knows she can infer from A is parallel to B, and A has this direction, to B has the same direction. But she hasn't done that yet, and she hasn't done that precisely because she hasn't attended to them and brought those two pieces of evidence together. So that's how we're going to represent her. So we're representing her as having these personal possibilities that include more than just the kind of metaphysically and logically possible possibilities that are representable with her representational resources, but also ones that are logically, or conceptually, I guess, in this case, impossible. And so if we do that, then we can understand the two evidence-gathering episodes as of the same kind of sort, and then we can compare them. So if she carries on counting, then we know that what the evidence function is that she will get by carrying on with that particular piece of inquiry. It's the one that at the end will tell her the true number of windows in the Chrysler Building. And if she does the other one, where she kind of reasons out from her evidence, she will learn in the end, the one at the top there, that Park Avenue indeed runs northeast as Madison Avenue. But those are two different possibilities, and we know that because she's a bounded agent, she can't do both of them. She's got to decide between them, and so we can just evaluate those two as different sorts of evidence-gathering episodes, just like my case where I pull out the Scotland's Highest Point pamphlet or the Challenging but Manageable pamphlet, and I get to choose between those two ways of gathering evidence. Similarly, Jane can just look at these and assess which of these two she would prefer to do. And for pragmatic reasons, it's almost certainly going to be to continue to count the windows in the building, because after all, you know, it's not going to be terribly useful to her, at least she can't anticipate yet, it's going to be terribly useful for her to know the direction of Park Avenue. Very useful to her, incredibly lucrative to know how many windows there are on the Chrysler Building, because that's going to give her bid for the glazing contract the best possibility. Okay. So that's the kind of way I think of representing that. And then in that case, you don't really get a clash between these two. They're just kind of, the answer to what she should do is just going to be that you should kind of do the whichever it is that that maximizes expected utility, whichever particular sort of expected utility you're interested in. Now, there's a problem that arises with this, because one standard criticism that's put to this sort of creedal approach to epistemology is that on its kind of its usual presentation, it requires a sort of logical omniscience. Why is that? Well, it's because usually when this is presented, people take the possibilities over which your propositions are defined that you then have credences in to be logically or metaphysically metaphysically possible possibilities. And if that's the case, since each of those, you know, some very, very complex logical fact is going to be true, then that's got to be something you've got to be certain in. One of the things that probabilism says is you've got to be certain in anything that's true at every single possibility. Now, you can avoid that problem by doing the thing that I've just suggested, which is kind of built on this suggestion of Ian Hacking. You can do that, but then you might think that exactly the opposite problem arises, that then things become far too permissive. Because take, for instance, some extremely simple logical truths like P or not P. According to this, it could be rational for me to be uncertain of that. Because, after all, I'm going to have personal possibilities where that's false, because I allow in logically impossible possibilities. And then I can give some credence to that, and then I can be less than certain of it. In fact, according to the kind of version of probabilism that you get if you allow these different logically impossible worlds in alongside the logically possible ones, I could have extremely low credence in P or not P and be perfectly rational. This is sometimes called the problem of logical obtuseness. But I think this paper where Ian Hacking introduces this, kind of, as an aside, gives, I think, what's a really nice answer to this problem. And the answer goes like this. There's two distinctive features about these very simple logical truths. One is, it would be very useful for you to be aware of them, maybe certain of them, at least to have very high credence. Lots and lots of decisions you're going to face where it would serve you very poorly if you were uncertain of whether P or not. Kind of end up setting expected utilities in ways that will kind of be guaranteed, lead you astray in such and such things. So that's one feature of them. The other feature of them is that they're very easy to acquire knowledge of, to acquire the evidence that they're true. Why? Because they don't really require terribly much logical reasoning. Do straightforward truth tables, that's what you know. Now, those two things then suggest that anyone who doesn't say certainty in them, or at least very high credence in them, is not maximizing their expected pragmatic utility. Because they're refusing to do this very, very low-cost thing that will get very, very high pragmatic utility out of the end. It will serve them very well in their decision-making, and it's very low-cost to do, and that's exactly the sort of case that you would think. That this kind of value of information framework tells you you're irrational if you don't do it. It's a little bit like if, you know, I knew that if only I were to look to my left now, I would learn something that would gain me £1 million later. If I were not to do it, you could rationally criticize me for not doing it. It's very low cost for me to do it. It's very high gain. But if I don't do it, then I'm irrational. And similarly, the person who doesn't require this kind of very simple logical evidence. Okay, so that's the kind of proposal for how to kind of understand Jane Friedman's kind of cases. And I mean, in some ways, the purpose here is a little bit more than just kind of deal with that particular case, but to create a unified account of inquiry that includes both logical reasoning, conceptual reasoning, empirical investigation, in such a way that we can then compare those things with one another. Because there's going to be cases where, often going to be cases where it's going to be one or another. I know I could do a little bit of mathematical reasoning, maybe that would improve things for me in some way. I could do some empirical investigation, maybe that would do some benefit for me in some way. But I've got to decide which of them to do. Perhaps I just can't do both of them. That's a little bit like what happens in the glacier. Okay. The next problem that's going to come up, or something that's come up in this literature that I think this account can help us. Well, yes, I think this can help us with, but then it's going to face a problem. I'm really using this kind of point here to kind of raise a problem against the account that I'm talking about and say how I think we should address it. So, Mona Simeon has recently worried about these cases where... So at the beginning I said that one of the criticisms that the inquiry literature has sort of levelled against traditional epistemology, if you like, is that it treats us as these passive agents. We kind of receive the evidence and then we've got to do something with it. But of course we're not. We go out and find certain sorts of things. But there's another way in which it seems to kind of fail to properly represent what's going on with us, is that it sort of assumes that you have certain evidence, and then it asks you how you should respond to that evidence. It doesn't suggest that there are certain cases where you're kind of epistemically failing by not even having the evidence in the first place. So Simeon's interested in cases where people resist evidence. She has all kind of examples of this where, for various reasons, people have evidence available to them, but they resist taking it on board and responding to it. And she wants to claim that, according to kind of traditional epistemology, there's nothing bad that you can say about that person, epistemically speaking. Why not? Because all that the standard kind of epistemic norms say is, if you have this evidence, then you should respond to it in a particular way. She says, no, there's sometimes cases where whether or not you have it, if it's available to you, you ought to have it, and then you ought to respond to it. So you should be able to epistemically criticize someone for not even taking on certain sorts of evidence, regardless of whether they end up. So G has this norm, I can't remember what DTB stands for, but a subject S has an epistemic duty to form a belief that X, if there is sufficient evidence, sufficient undefeated evidence for S, supporting X. So, I mean, this is part of the kind of tenor of both the paper and the book that came out of it, is that there are kind of positive epistemic obligations as well as negative ones. Now, one good feature of the account I've been given is that it helps us understand this this phrase, there's an epistemic duty to believe something if there is sufficient and undefeated evidence for us. Because that's a little bit mysterious in this account. In fact, Simeon does say some things about this. Because it's not just going to be the case that the evidence is somehow there available to you, because this whole framework has kind of been trying to convince you that even if evidence is there and available to you, sometimes it's not right to collect it because we're bounded creatures and it might be that doing something else is better for us instead of collecting it. So there isn't anything kind of particularly bad about this. So you've got to give some sort of story about when it seems bad for someone to have evidence available to them but not to acquire it, not to sort of take it on. You know, for instance, you know, there are information I can get by looking there, looking there, looking there, looking there. And each of those, they're kind of available to me. There are, you know, the things that I could do, but I say I can't do all of them. I guess I did just do all of them, but perhaps I'm in a situation where I can't do all of them. And so I've got to, you know, you can't say just because they're there that I have some obligation to take them on. So I think this framework gives a kind of nice account of this. It tells you that, well, what does it mean for the evidence to be such that you have this obligation to take it on? Well, if doing that uniquely maximizes your expected utility, again, whether that utility is epistemic or pragmatic or all things considered. And Simeon was particularly interested in epistemic duties to do this, so she would really be interested to spell out her ideas here. You would want this to be epistemic utility that's maximized on expectation by acquiring the evidence. Okay, so I think it gives that kind of that sort of nice account. But there is this problem that arises for exactly this reason. So you imagine some of the cases that Simeon's interested in, for instance, a sexist who resists evidence of a woman's competence that they're with whom they're interacting. Now, there's kind of plenty of evidence available to them, but they're not taking it on. They're not kind of, you know, coming to learn that evidence. But according to the account I've been sketching, you could imagine a way in which that could end up being rational, because suppose the sexist doesn't much care about the accuracy of the propositions that they would get information about. That's indeed part of their sexism. They don't much care about these propositions that they would thereby get evidence for. And moreover, you could imagine, and Simeon has kind of examples of this with climate change deniers, of people who kind of have a particular investment in, you know, their identity as someone who believes this sort of thing. And so they might take it to be a great cost to them if they were to gain evidence that would kind of tell against their belief, and they thereby come to lose that belief. But if you put that into the framework I've been spelling out, it looks like it's perfectly rational for the person to resist this evidence because they don't much care about the improvement the evidence would give them, and it would have a great cost to them. So the problem is, if you do all of this evaluation from the subject's own point of view of their utilities, then you could get, from their subjective point of view, it's perfectly rational for them to resist evidence. So we still want to somehow be able to capture what Simeon's getting at, I think, with this intuition. But I think we can. And that's essentially because this framework that I'm sort of spelling out is very flexible. It's certainly true that, you know, very often what we want to do is evaluate particular bit of evidence gathering or particular credences or something from the agent's own point of view, from the point of view of their utilities. You want to look at what they value and then ask, is it kind of worth it for them to gather particular sorts of evidence? But in the cases we're looking at here, the person in some ways has the wrong utilities, or indeed utilities that we would criticize in a particular way. For instance, they have this kind of deep commitment to sort of their identity as a sexist, and you might think that's okay, that's going to be a kind of morally or in some ways criticizable set of utilities. And so what you should do instead is evaluate whether they should gather this evidence, when instead of thinking about the actual utilities they have, which you think of as flawed in some ways, how would they evaluate it from the point of view of unflawed utilities? So this is in some ways just to kind of point out that this framework can help us understand cases like this, and that it's got this sort of flexibility to allow you to evaluate things from different points of view. I've also been kind of always evaluating this from the point of view of the agent's own prior credences. You might think they're flawed as well, because perhaps they're formed as a result of kind of years of not taking on certain sorts of evidence. In some ways, while it's going to be very complex to do, there's kind of no in principle problem with that for this framework, because you can just take the credences in some sense they should have, and you can understand what they should be as well, because they're the credences that they would have were they to have in fact acquired all of the evidence that they should have acquired across the course of those years. So there's lots of different ways you can use this framework, I've been kind of spelling out, to evaluate people. You can do it from their point of view of their own utilities, from the point of view of some more kind of objective or not flawed utilities. You can do it from different points of view of different prior credences and so on. But just to kind of wrap up, I want to move a little bit, well, in some ways move from the opposite of gathering evidence to losing evidence. So one thing that hopefully this lecture is sort of made clear is that the framework I've been spelling out, although in some ways it's become associated with a sort of ideal epistemology, kind of very, kind of very ideal norms, you should sort of satisfy probabilism, should always update exactly by conditionalization and all these sorts of things. The teleological approach that I've been spelling out in some sense is not restricted to that. In fact, it should be very, very well suited to non-ideal sorts of situations, situations where you recognize that the sorts of epistemic individuals that we are very bounded in certain ways. We've got kind of limited time and limited cognitive resources, and we're in limited information environments and so on. And why is that? Well, because you can kind of use this teleological approach to evaluate what someone should do when their options are limited. In fact, that's essentially what happened in the case of Jane the Glazier, when she's kind of looking and trying to got two options. She's able to count the number of windows in the Chrysler Building, or she's able to do this alternative thing, spell out her evidence. She can't do both of them. Why not? Because she's a bounded agent. But nonetheless, this framework can allow us to tell between these two. So I want to just finish by just mentioning one, I think I'll just get to one other sort of consequence of us not being ideal that you could use this framework to account for as well, which is forgetting. So as well as kind of acquiring evidence, we sometimes offload that evidence. And in these cases, we're not doing it intentionally. If you've ever tried to forget something, it's certainly the worst way to in fact forget things. But you can nonetheless use the framework to evaluate whether or not it's rational to. It would be rational for someone to do it. You can still use the person's credences and you still evaluate the act of forgetting, even if the person themselves couldn't kind of do that, or if they did and then decided to do it, they would fail. How do you do this? Well, you've then got to kind of create a model of what happens when we forget information, so that's going to be pretty controversial, but I'll just kind of put out a very, very simplistic one. So suppose you've got Verity, let's say Verity again. She's got credences in, it's going to rain tomorrow, it's going to be sunny, it's going to be very sunny. It's kind of 4/9 in rain, 4/9 in sunny, and 1/9 in very sunny. And then she learns that it's not going to be very sunny. Okay, so she learns it's either going to be rain or sunny, and so she updates her credences on the basis of that. And now let's say she forgets that bit of information. So what happens when you forget a piece of information that you previously had? There's lots of different stories about what might happen here, but one thing that might happen is that you revert back to what you had before. So there's people who think there's kind of these your prior credences that you kind of carry around with you across your life. So just kind of are the credences you would have when you have no evidence at all, and then what you should credences you should have at any particular time is just those credences conditioned on the evidence you have at that time. And people like that will think, if I start here with certain evidence, I gain some new evidence and move to this, and then I lose that evidence, then what's going to happen is I'm just going to revert back to that original thing. That's not the only story you could tell, but you could tell a story like that. And in that case, you can just use your kind of earlier credences, your middle credences there, the half, half, zero ones, to evaluate the kind of later credences, credences you would have as a result. Now, all of the ways of evaluating that I've been talking about have this property of being strictly proper. And what that means is that they're going to think, that the half-half-zero credences are going to think they're going to be worse off if you forget and you revert back to 4/9, 4/9, 1/9. But, and this is where the non-ideal comes in, there's some cost to retaining evidence. This is presumably why we in fact forget, because we're not unlimited storage devices. So all you have to do then is figure out whether it's rational for you to forget, is to figure out whether the cost that you have by retaining that information is outweighed by the cost you get by forgetting is outweighed by the gain you get by freeing up some storage space. And of course that's going to be different across different cases. It's going to be very sort of specific. And so that brings me to the very last thing I want to say, which is that one thing that this can kind of look like is it looks like every single case is incredibly specific. It's very, in some ways, very particular. It's going to look like you need to know all these details about the specific situation to figure out whether the person's rational. And in some sense, that can be a little bit out of keeping with how we sometimes do epistemology, where we look for kind of big, chunky norms like the one that Friedman gives. You know, if one has excellent credence for X at T, then one is permitted to judge X at T. We look for that sort of thing. But in fact, I think it's what's going to turn out is that in all those kind of cases, there's going to end up being counterexamples to them once we start looking at kind of our non-ideality. But then to kind of figure out what the general principle is that we should use instead, we're going to have to kind of fill in all these kind of tiny little details about exactly what the cost is for retaining this evidence and losing this evidence and moving from this to that. And so essentially what you want instead is some sort of principle like the one I've been saying, which is something like just maximize expected utility. That allows you to input all of the specifics of the situation and then get out what you should do in it. Okay, I'll finish there. Thanks very much.